This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey people, how's it going? Are you managing to survive the existential clusterfuck of pain and misery being brought about by the fact that these bastards... I shouldn't do this kind of intro, should I? These narcissistic sociopaths are in charge of the world, steering the ship right off the edge of a cliff. This is a photography podcast. This is Ben. You're listening to episode 115 of my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Welcome along and thank you for tuning in. That's an archaic piece of old school radio terminology, isn't it? I shouldn't even say that, but I like it. It's not relevant any longer in podcast land. This week on the podcast features my wide-ranging chat with the British photographer David Moore. Before I introduce David properly, I will do the usual spiel, but I will keep it short. Don't forget, if you are a regular listener and you think that this podcast, with or without the ranty intro, is worth the price of a cup of coffee per episode, then please do sign up for a very small recurring monthly subscription. Or if you prefer, make a larger occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/a small voice. Please leave a positive review on iTunes, regardless of whichever country you happen to be in. Let's get some good 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you don't think it's 5 stars, then 4's fine. If you think it's less than 4, then please email me and tell me why it sucks so much. And if you happen to need a new website, I can make you a new website so you don't have to do it, because it is a bit of a pain in the butt, and I do that using the Squarespace platform. Okay, this episode is brought to you by the awesome Charcoal Book Club. Now, Charcoal, as you may have heard in previous episodes, have now opened the call for entries for the 4th annual Chico Hot Springs Portfolio Review and Publishing Prize. So you can now submit your work until December the 9th for a chance to be one of 58 artists invited to spend the week in Montana with Alessandra Sanguinetti, Jim Goldberg, Vanessa Winship, Todd Heido, Awashka van der Molen, Raymond Meeks, and 15 of the most respected publishers and organisations in contemporary photography. Attending artists will receive formal portfolio reviews by speakers and reviewers, artist lectures, panel discussions, peer reviews, and additional evening programming over the 7-day event. And one grand prize winner will be awarded the Charcoal Publishing Prize and will be published and distributed worldwide by a Charcoal Book Club. So for more details, for more information, and to apply, visit chicoreview.com, chicoreview.com. Massively looking forward to that myself. Hope to see you there next April in the lovely Chico Hot Springs in Montana. So David Moore is a London-based photographic artist, once described as belonging to the second wave of new colour documentary in Britain. He has exhibited and published internationally, and his work is held in public and private collections. David has worked as a photographer and educator since graduating from the West Surrey College of Art and Design in Farnham in 1988, and he is currently the course leader of the MA Documentary Photography and Photojournalism at the University of Westminster. David's 2017-2018 project Lisa and John responds to the archive of his influential 1988 graduation project, Pictures from the Real World, which was published as a book in 2011, and employs theatre, installation and collaboration. Lisa and John was launched at the Format International Photography Festival in 2017 and included a theatrical play, the Lisa and John Slideshow, written and directed by David. The entire Lisa and John project was exhibited and performed in London and Belfast in 2018 and has received widespread acclaim. The writer Sean O'Hagan wrote of David, "Moore is such a master of colour that he made me think more than once what William Eggleston's photographs would have looked like had he been born in the north of England rather than the American South." David's current practice addresses agency and a critique of documentary as a genre, using installation and theatre as a means of posing questions around the production of knowledge through photography. So a lot of that will be explained in the talk that is to follow, or the chat that is to follow. Enjoyed meeting David very much. We had this little chat in his kitchen here in London, a mere stone's throw from where later that night I went back to the launch of the Lisa and John Slideshow. And the actors who play Lisa and John were there to do a reading, and it was great. So anyway, here's my chat with the William Eggleston of the North, David Moore. Loads of learnings to be made here, kids. So, yeah, it's a kind of a auspicious day because you've got this launch later. But we're gonna talk more about what it is that's being launched because you have a new book out, which is called The Lisa and John Slideshow. And that's published by Machina Books, who I didn't know about, but they're a little sort of independent imprint here in London. But before we get there, we need to fill in all the blanks, really. So I think it's probably easiest if we just kind of go right back to the beginning. You were born in Derby.
No, I was not.
Oh, you grew up in Derby.
I grew up in Derby. I moved to Derby when I was 6 weeks old. Okay. I actually was born in Blackburn, Lancashire.
Okay.
But only stuck around for a short amount of time.
Yeah, so kind of a technicality.
Was transported to the East Midlands from Lancashire.
Right. Yeah. So what was Derby like at that point then, in the sort of the late 60s, early 70s? What are your memories of that place?
Well, it was home, and Derby was and still is very much a working class city, born by industry at the time as a child, up until sort of probably late 80s, British Rail before it was broken up, and Rolls-Royce Limited, Rolls-Royce were the significant two significant industrial employers, and that's Rolls-Royce Aero Engines. So Everybody had a member of the family who worked at one or the other of those two institutions. And of course, in the 60s, early 70s, it was a bit of a boom time. I remember Rolls-Royce crashing because my dad worked there as a senior production engineer. And I remember Rolls-Royce having difficulties in 70-71. The company was reformed in 71, but they continued to be a strong company.
So it was like not a bad time for a working class kind of family, because the industry and all that stuff was doing okay. It was a reasonably kind of healthy economy and all that kind of stuff.
It felt like that. I never suffered any economic hardship in my upbringing at all. My dad was always working.
Mum
worked at home.
Did she?
It was sort of comfortable upbringing.
Yeah. Kind of middle class rather than
I'd always pitch
class.
It somewhere in between the two,
yeah,
which
I do
is
that.
Kind of perhaps typically socially agnostic. I always put it somewhere in the middle.
Yeah,
I never
yeah.
whether to, I think I sort of say upper working, lower middle, and I'm not
right.
quite sure which one should actually lead in that description. But that would actually define it really well for me, because both of my parents are from working class backgrounds.
Right.
But Dad had other aspirations through his professional approach to work and his associated hobbies, and he listened to classical music, he made wine.
Mm.
At some point in my sort of, I think, early adolescence, he stopped buying the Daily Mirror and started buying the Daily Express, right? And I can't remember when that was, actually, but I remember it being significant.
Yeah, significant moment. Oh, well, he must have handed some of that kind of ethos down to you then, you know, the sort of aspirational sort of tendency.
I think so. I mean, I think it was very clear to me from very early on that I was not going to be an engineer, that I had to do something creative, something with imagery. Had to do something that was expressive, to use a particular word that I don't use very often. But certainly the ambition to leave the small city was there from sort of teenage years on, in actual fact, yeah.
But then you messed up your exams, didn't you?
Like, you've been listening to the other stuff.
So why did that happen then?
Why did I mess up my exams?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually.
Because I did the same thing, so I'm always curious when someone else has done that.
Mm. Yeah, you know, and I look back at it, really. I mean, I was bright at school.
I'm assuming.
Getting good grades, you know. But maybe there's some self-destruct thing about not wanting to get on in that city and to reinvent myself somewhere else.
Right.
Which took some years to do, because I stuck around in Derby for a while working. I worked at DHSS for some good number
right,
of years
which
before
is the
I left to go to university.
Department of Health and Social Security.
So that's
for my listeners in Kansas City, that basically means what would you call it? The sort of unemployed... Welfare department would be dealing with kind of unemployment and benefits and all that. Yeah, sorry, just to give that...
And I think that was a reaction also to... Because I messed up my exams at 16... I saw that all of my contemporaries at that point who were leaving school at 16 were offered apprenticeships in industry. And I did not want to do that. So going to become a civil servant was a kind of kickback against that to a certain extent.
Right, right.
You know, not industry, I'm working with people. But of course, I found myself in very compromising situations in that space because I was often wanting to pay out more money than the state would allow me to do.
Yeah. So were you quite politicised at that point, or did it politicise you doing that job?
What politicised me were at that age were two things. One was the music press, reading the New Musical Express, and being aware of the burgeoning politics of the Conservative Party on the horizon. So we're talking 77, 78, being aware of Margaret Thatcher. And reading a quote from Lindy Kwesi Johnson, who said that the idea of a Thatcher government is an extremely disturbing one. And that was something that woke me up to what was happening. So there was one thing there, through music, through movements like Rock Against Racism, set up by the photographer Red Saunders, who I've since met, lovely man. So there was that, there's music, the way music was politicised in ways that it isn't now.
Right.
Maybe there's a little resurgence. And also the miners' strike, which occurred in the Midlands and the North in the early to mid 80s.
Right, at the height of Thatcherism, which, you know,
that's
so
right.
You sort of, yeah, all that came right at the point in which you were.
Yeah, you so know, you have this ideological 20s. Battle between the really the last stand of the unions, right, and a Conservative government who were embracing the free market. And I remember working for the civil service. We were banned because there were rallies at lunchtime in the marketplace in Derby, and we were banned from going to these rallies as employees of the government. Of course, we all went.
Yeah, yeah.
And listened to Scargill and other people talking about
Arthur Scargill, famous union
Scargill.
Leader.
Yeah. So there are two things there which kind of. Became significant for me.
So that was the sort of political backdrop to your kind of 20s, and well, of course Margaret Thatcher survived for a great many years, but when did the photography become a thing for you then, an interest?
Well, actually, again, through music was my sort of entree. I was buying the New Musical Express and I was looking at people like Anton Corbijn, and enjoying this this apparent freedom to reinvent what could have been a very staid way of doing things. It's interesting there. I mentioned the photographer Brian Griffin to you earlier on before we started recording. And so there's two things. One is the music photography in NME, etc. But also my dad used to receive a subscription to a magazine called Management Today. Now, Management Today was a magazine where Brian Griffin and other photographers cut their commercial teeth as young photographers. And I do remember looking at this photography in Management Today and thinking how extraordinary it is and how I'd never seen anything like it whatsoever. And that was a little thing that sort of unconsciously went in some ways, you know, to kind of just for there as a seed in some way.
Right, right.
I think the other thing for me also was the fact that we made an annual pilgrimage in the summer holidays with my mum as a child to Derby Museum and Art Gallery, where there's a collection of Joseph Wright of Derby paintings, two of which are in the National now, one of which is in the National now. So I remember going to see these, the experiment with the bird and gas pump, and the orrery, one of the other, I can't remember which one, was at Derby. But I remember seeing this extraordinary visual tableau with darkness and colour as a child, and it having an impact on me. So there's kind of three sort of areas there where sort of the visual started to become important.
Right, right. You did go and study in Farnham, at the art college there, which is a pretty renowned institution, I guess. Was it? I guess it was, especially at that time. What are your sort of memories of that place, and you know, what kind of ethos did it have?
So it was West. We're talking about West Surrey College of Art and Design,
right,
as it was described, as it was called then, in Farnham. So it's an hour out of Waterloo, where not far from where we're sitting now. And I was attracted to it. I saw a portfolio of work in a photography magazine. I thought, this is amazing work, and I wanted to be there. So I found that was where I applied. I got in. And it was a very exciting time for British photography, actually, or international photography as well, but British particularly, because you had the sort of appearance of people like Paul Graham and Martin Parr, who were beginning to, they're in the ascendant in terms of their practice, alongside a awareness of more of a post-structural practice that was coming out of Polytechnic of Central London.
Right. You see, I'm very sort of unacademic in my sort of understanding of art, and so I never know what any of these terms mean. Yeah. And I wonder whether really I ought to. I mean, you know, or you know, maybe you think that, you know, young photographers now ought to learn this stuff. But yeah, what does all that? You know, what are those?
Well, for me, I became aware of these different ways of approaching representing the world, and was excited by what I could describe as the modernism that was happening at Farnham. It was a reinvention of modernist documentary practice. So we were interested in form, we were interested in colour. We, because the times were more political, we were engaged in that sense as well. There were ideas being played out.
Yeah.
Contemporaries of mine were people like Paul Seawright and Anna Fox.
Right.
So we're all engaged with the social in some ways. So so representation wasn't questioned as much as just something that was there. Whereas if you think about it more post-structurally, the work that was coming out of PCL, for example.
Polytechnic of Central London.
Yeah, so Victor Bergen's course.
Another well-known institution here.
Indeed, yeah.
Especially at that time.
Yeah, so we're looking at practice which is, which sort of started to disassemble the way we were doing things in some ways.
Right,
and started to draw on lots of French philosophy to kind of find difficult areas with the legacies of documentary practice and the way documentary practice function.
Mm-mm.
So that's what I mean by that. So there's this fantastic conflict, really.
Right.
Which, you know, I mean, we're going to be talking about theatre later. I mean, the idea of establishing conflict at the beginning of any act is what what a writer tries to do.
And you've got this sort of, well, then you get this kind of back and forth, kind of almost like an argument going on in a way, or a conversation going on, but between institutions rather than people in a way.
Yeah, that's interesting to look at it as an institutional thing, actually. I mean, there were people who worked at PCL who came to teach us at Farnham, and it was no accident that they were there. And it's, you know, the guy who ran the course, a very kind of amiable and fantastic course leader called Peter Hall, who himself was a sculptor. I don't think there's any accident that these people were invited down give us theory lessons, for example,
right,
where we had this kind of momentum of, you know, colour, modernism, you know, new colour, new British colour, that we had this theoretical sort of thorn in our side as well.
And like, but you were as fascinated by that stuff as you were by the kind of practical business of taking pictures, or not? Was it all part of the same thing to you?
Taking pictures was the primary thing for me,
and
figuring these things out with work that I did rather than theoretically was the sort of the primary thing. And that's not to say I ignored it, because I didn't. I brought it into my practice at that stage. It's kind of how I teach now, actually. Mm. You know, I like to think that we can think through photography and then figure things out later as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then you get, it's almost like that's the best of both worlds in a way, if you do that. But so what were your influences? Because you sort of started off with a black and white kind of practice. Is it really true to say that even in the sort of mid to late 80s, the idea of colour was a bit frowned upon, or had we got over that by that stage? Because I'd kind of read somewhere that it was still a bit of an issue. You know, it was a bit of a stigma that, you know, if you shot colour, you weren't quite serious.
Yeah, I think there was a little bit of that still lingering around when we were at Farnham. But nothing kind of, we were being taught by these, you know, young British photographers who were getting shows and making work that was re-seeing society.
Mm.
And of course, along with that came lots of American precedent. So you became aware of other photographers who've been working in colour for years and years, and the new topographics that was happening in the US as well. So there's plenty to draw on. So we just considered it was sort of old buddy daddies who would think stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, you had some sort of influences who were kind of already setting the agenda, as it were, or kind of, you know, showing the way, leading the way.
Yeah, we're sort of
Eggleston and people like that. Who were you really interested in?
Me initially, before I got to Farnham, Joel Mavich was kind of a big sort of, you know, one of the first books I got regularly out of the library, you know, because I did an A-level photography in the evening at Derby College of Higher Education. And obviously other people, not just colour, but Bill Brandt, Cartier-Bresson, all the sort of obvious people that you would go to. Ruth Orkin was an odd one that kind of grabbed me at the beginning.
Right.
But yeah, Eggleston was there as well, Lewis Boltz, lots of sort of things that people perhaps still come to now if they're looking properly from a particular period.
Yeah. Well, you were in the so-called second wave of British colour.
I don't know who coined that.
I don't know who coined that. And the first wave, as I think we've already sort of mentioned, would be people like Paul Graham and Martin Parr.
Yeah.
And who else, who would have been in the second one with you then? Any names come to mind?
So Paul Seawright, Anna Fox.
Right. So these were actually your contemporaries at college?
They were Farnham people, yeah. There are others as well.
Great. Well, I always try and put links in the show notes for people so they can, you know, if they don't know who these people are, they can go and find the links and then check them out. It's all part of the service, folks. But but then, yeah, you were quite influenced by a particular book, which was Paul Graham's A1. And that, I think, probably was quite an inflection point for you in terms of moving to medium format moving to colour, maybe.
Yeah, moving to colour. So saw Paul's book. I've been looking at all the American things that we've been talking about. So Mavich, Lewis Boltz, Stephen Shaw, Joel Sternfeld, all of that sort of work. And then suddenly found a version of it with English light, rather than the relative ease of American light, and sort of all of the romance that's associated with that, that still sort of sustains careers to this day of various photographers we can talk about. And so suddenly I found this sort of notion of it in the greys, the grey hues of the A1, the Great North Road. By Paul, I didn't know anything about it, and I remember it was an amazing moment. It made me then start to work in transparency. That's what I did. I didn't shift to medium format for a little while, but it made me consider the sort of landscape and the world around me in a different photographic frame of reference, for sure.
Right. So the medium format shift came later. Was that the influence of college that sort of
brought that about? Really. Access to cameras, darkrooms, and so on and so forth. Working from medium format very early on, square cameras and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So trying out Mamiya's.
What did you like about that format, though? The square.
Well, I mean, on a very sort of simple. Well, it wasn't so much. I don't think they had any rectangular. I don't think they had any 6.7s. That might have been
what was given.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. But it's exciting. Suddenly your pictures look different, you know, and it forces you to work in different ways and so on and so forth.
It's a lovely thing. I mean, and someone, I can't remember who made the very simple and obvious comment that, if you're shooting square, then you don't have to make a decision about, which way up to hold the camera because it's square, so it takes that out.
I agree with that, actually.
You do not?
No. You've still got to sort of arrange the mise-en-scene in the frame, of course,
the composition, but I'm saying is you don't...
I'm saying you don't make the portrait landscape.
Yeah, it takes that out of the equation. I mean, it might sound simplistic, but I think I quite like the fact that there's, you're just taking one more thing away.
One of the interesting things about twin lenses that you don't hold the camera up to your face when you're making the photograph. That's one of the interesting things. When I worked on a later series called The Velvet Arena, which became my first show at the Photographers Gallery in 1994, first solo show at the Photographers Gallery in 1994. I was very aware of that, working in social situations in London where I'm just going to private views and I'm just sort of shooting and people are sort of, you know, I was being kind of quite quiet about the way I was working and moving around a room and,
yeah,
you know, there was no alarm bells going off when I lifted my hands right, up to my face.
Yeah, a lot of people do talk about it. It's a little bit more discreet and maybe a little bit more sort of acceptable or
in part,
less intimidating if you're looking down on the thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So the project that became Pictures from the Real World, which is possibly the thing that you're maybe best known for, was actually part of your degree?
It was my degree show.
It was your degree show,
yeah. It was my degree show, yeah.
Yeah, and so this involved you going back to Derby to shoot. But tell me about how it kind of came about in terms of, you know, the initial idea for you.
Well, in my third year of my BA, I lived in Derby. There was a sort of a very loose arrangement with the university. You could travel. There's also a little-known agreement between Derby College of Higher Education and Farnham where students could use dark rooms at either end of the country. I think I was the only person ever to take advantage of that, actually.
And well,
it was just a word of mouth thing, you know, between course leaders who used to go to the pub together or something. So I moved back. I knew that I wanted to make some work about my hometown. I started making street photographs in areas that were about a mile away from where I was living. And this took me to the housing estate where I eventually shot pictures from the real world. I started off as a sort of wandering around, taking photographs on the street. I got to know people. Decided to push it a little bit further and knock on doors, people I'd been saying hi to, and sort of went from there, really, and eventually ended up in a situation where I'm sort of passed around different families, and I had about three or four families I was working with at the busiest time. This was like over an eight-month period, I think, I was working. So that's how it sort of starts to develop, yeah.
And but did you find that before you started knocking on doors, were you shooting and not really getting what you wanted from it? You know, was there some sort of dissatisfaction in what you were producing before you took it that step further?
Yeah, there's a sort of a real sort of need to know that photographers have, I think. And being on the other side of one's front door of an unknown home was a sort of unknown territory. I feel differently about it now, having done quite a bit of it. But at that time, there was a sort of, and it's quite transgressive as well, I think, to go in someone else's home and step over the threshold of someone else's.
You feel that because it's in some way you're intruding in some way or whatever, even if it's consensual on their part.
Yeah, well, there's this kind of, I was actually talking about this with students yesterday, the idea of there's this term informed consent.
Right.
And, of course, everyone I work with, I said to them, if you don't want me here, just say so. And two or three of them, you know, did boot me out after a while because it's quite a big deal. I'm 6'3" and I have a flash.
Yeah.
And I can't hide myself, you know. So that was one thing. There were people who sort of rejected my sort of presence after two or three trips, two or three visits, and didn't want to do it, which is obviously understandable. I mean, when I think about it now, it seems absurd. It seems a sort of a request that one can make in one's youth through sort of naivety and a sort of overdeveloped self-belief in practice.
Right.
You know, when I think about that, I mean, when I think about the audacity of actually thinking one can do it. I know we're in very different times now.
Well, I always say the same thing, you know, that there's a sort of, you know, you can get away with a lot when you have that kind of youthful exuberance that people seem to respond to it. And, you know, people will accept stuff that there's no way they'd accept if you're rocked up, you know, as a, you know, 40 something, just as an example.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah. that's it. You know, I'm a youth and I'm doing this. You know, I'm a tall, skinny youth and I'm doing this.
Yeah,
but the thing about the family is that I was talking about informed consent. and what that actually means. And it's sort of impossible to give informed consent, that's what I'm going to say. Because I was asked a question the other day by somebody from the BJP who said, did you ever imagine in the 1980s that this piece of work would become a play?
Mm.
And I said, I did not imagine that.
How but, could you?
So, you know, I couldn't explain that to people then, of course. But, of course, there's more to say about the relationship between Lisa and John when we start to talk about
it. Yeah, I think we should get to it because people are going to be intrigued by that comment because it has become a play and we will explain exactly why and how. Yeah. But we need to actually, well, talk about who Lisa and John were. Lisa and John were two of the people from one of the families that you spent a fair amount of time with.
That's right.
Yeah.
So Lisa and John were one of the families and it really ended up being the family that I spent more time with than any other. The Pictures from the Real World is a very small book. It's about 18 photographs. It's very severe in my edit.
Mm. I wanted to ask you about why that was, but maybe you want to come back to that.
Yeah. So Lisa and John were and one of the easiest families to work with because their home was a hub for community. There's always people there. Right. There's always lots of kids running around. You know, it was always sort of chaotic, and I could just be there very easily.
Mm.
Lisa was fantastically open and friendly as well, as she is now, to my sort of presence. So, yeah, that's how that worked.
Right. So, like, just to sort of be quite nuts and bolts about it, what was your sort of modus operandi then? Did you sort of arrange the next date that you were going to show up, you know, at a time, or did you just literally show up as and when, you know, you had a moment, or was it quite a regular routine? What was the kind of deal?
Yeah, we had arrangements, really, where I said, I'd shot for half a day, and I said, can I come next Monday, Tuesday? Right. So we did a sort of a rolling thing like that.
Mm-mm.
It's a long time ago. I mean, occasionally, I think I might have just rocked up and said, is it okay, and then she let me in or not.
Right.
Yeah.
So... yeah, you've talked quite a lot about this idea of it being transgressive. I mean, were you uncomfortable being there at the time? And, you know, like, is there some... Because I think this is something that a lot of photographers probably have experienced or that young photographers might, you know, to some extent sort of struggle with, is that feeling of discomfort. And I'm just wondering how you felt about that and how you, you know, managed to kind of carry on anyway, because ultimately one has to, if you're there to shoot pictures, you've got to kind of get over that. So yeah, could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean what I want to say at the top of that is that, I mean, and again this is for later on, but I mean the whole Lisa and John project is a response to the feelings that you're describing 30 years afterwards.
Right.
Right.
So, right.
Yes, there's the this when you're there, there's an ambivalence, there's an uncertainty. What carries you is, again, a sort of youthful momentum and almost a sort of psychological need to make work in this set of circumstances where you have an idea about what it is you're trying to do, but you can't say it until you see it. All of those things that, you know, all people who are working on open-ended projects experience. And the idea of a sort of vision of it, trying to get something but you don't know what it is. So that's the mystical description.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
of a sort of working process that I think will be familiar to many photographers and artists, actually. Not just photographers, many artists.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that sustains, really. And I think, I mean, again, I say to my students now, I mean, you know, we talk about theoretical ideas and we put context around production of work, talk about different discourses that surround the production of bodies of work. But my view is that to let that guide you too much is the wrong thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And one should sort of make work and figure it out afterwards, really. Otherwise, you're sort of beholden, you know, one orthodoxy is the same as any other.
Mm.
I mean, it means it's kind of replacing one orthodoxy just for another.
Mm.
And so I think there's more of a sort of an innate and human urge to produce, which is more important to actually work with rather than preset theoretical ideas.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so what happened was it did not become a book for many years. I have it in front of me here, the upside down version, one with a fault in the production, but Pictures from the Real World. It was published ultimately in 2012, but I mean, at the time it was, as you say, it was your degree show, and I think it ended up in a spread in Creative Camera magazine, which was a very sort of influential magazine, which I've heard a bit about over the course of talking to a bunch of people. I know it was Martin Parr who made that happen, wasn't
That's
it? How
right.
did that come about?
Martin was there as a visiting lecturer, very involved with the development of the course in some ways. And he was very well connected and had fingers in many pies. And he happened to be on terms with Peter Turner, who was the then editor of Creative Camera. As you rightly say, it was one of three serious photography magazines at that time, maybe two serious photography magazines at that time. And I think if you were a sort of artist photographer, then it was the one you wanted to be in.
Right.
So Martin chose two of us from Farnham for an issue called State of the Art in 1988.
Right.
And I had four photographs in that. So obviously very pleased. It was a great thing to graduate with.
Yeah.
A little sort of notation, if you like, of what I was trying to do at that time. So...
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, because I was just thinking about whether, you know, at any point, you kind of wished it had been a book before that actually happened.
You know, I put it away. It was a really funny thing. You know, I sort of devalued it in some ways.
Right.
You know, because it was
because you were young when you shot it. And also, it's like, well, that was just my degree show. How could that be any? Did you have a confidence that it was good?
There was a lack of sort of self belief and a lack of in the practice and I mean, I knew it was good work actually, but I moved to London and I got on with something else and I sort of left it behind, and that something else became the Velvet Arena, and then there were other commissions and bodies of work after that, and so there's this momentum of producing new stuff all the time. And not looking back. So, I mean, it was sort of forgotten. It was, you know, I didn't forget about it. I knew it was always there.
Just went into
but
the
it was just
archive, kind
in,
of.
It was in the archive, that's right. It was in a box under my bed, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah.
Right? So what happened was the British photography collector, James Hyman, got to know of the work and approached me in 2011, I think it was. And... I sold some work to him, so that sort of activated sort of the possibility of doing something with this work at that time.
Right,
coincided with the death of Margaret Thatcher too, yeah. Which seemed to be a sort of apposite time to think about publishing this body of work. So it's because there's all sorts of obviously causal connections between the living conditions of people I was photographing.
Yeah.
And her policies. More complicated than that, but it was very much of its time in that sense. And so James bought a load of pictures. I thought, maybe I could do a book here. And I'd already done a book with Dowie Lewis, so I made a PDF, put it on my phone. We met in a pub, I showed him the pictures on my phone, and we went from there.
Wow, really? Yeah. And it ultimately did get published, between a kind of collaboration between Dowie
and
Hearpress.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, let's fill in that little gap first before we talk more about it, because you mentioned the Velvet Arena, so that was one of the things you did once you'd moved to London in the 90s. But what were you doing for a living? Were you teaching at that point, or like did you ever go through a phase of doing commercial jobs, or you did? So that was something that was part of your world.
Yeah, I know. I knew that I wanted to do that. I moved to London in 1989 and started to build a commercial career, shooting for magazines, small magazines, a variety of stuff, studio stuff. You know, just starting out, portraits here and there.
So you weren't starving in a garret, kind of that kind of photographer.
Well, occasionally I was in the early days. But and then moving up, you know, working for the Observer and the Times and the Telegraph and stuff like that. And as one does, you know, did a bit of higher end commercial stuff as well.
Right, right. Okay.
So, I had a commercial career, and the economic sort of discourse allowed photographers to, I mean, allowed me and many of my contemporaries to run one's own commercial career versus alongside a sort of gallery and book career as well.
Mm.
The two were intertwined for a very while. In fact, it went very well together because there was a time in the mid-90s where, you know, lots of advertising agencies and, you know, Observer magazine were looking for this way of looking at the world. So there's quite a lot of interest in the commercial sense in that time. So that went on for over 15 years. I had a career. Now, I taught as well. I did little bits of teaching in the meantime at Farnham and different places.
Right. So it was a sort of fairly typical kind of multi-stranded kind of income sort of lifestyle that you had. As someone who, you know, is very involved in educating the kind of younger generation who perhaps have aspirations to survive in that way, what do you tell them, or what's your perception of how possible that is now to do?
Well, it's incredibly difficult to do now.
Mm.
When I look at the sort of my first invoice from 1988 being 160 quid for half a day's work, it's probably more than people get now.
I was going to say, that's probably not that far off what they're getting now.
Well, there's a sort of indication of how it's shifted.
Yeah.
And so we can't tell students that they are going to be, you know, commercial hotshots at all. It's going to be really difficult. However, we do, of course, tell people that studying photography is a fantastic discipline to draw out other ways of engaging with the world, which are useful in a variety of different situations. And that is the truth. I do believe in that. Of working with different people, problem solving, thinking outside. I'm not going to say thinking outside the box, but I just have done because I hate that phrase. But, just being on your feet.
Really. Yeah. So it has value outside of the specifics.
Indeed. Acquiring a sort of independent way of viewing things.
Yeah.
I think it's one
That's
thing.
That's a good point.
You know, photography degree at undergrad and postgrad especially affords the participant.
Mm. I just want to ask you about the Velvet Arena, because that was one of the projects that you did at this phase, as it were. You know, like you say, you were doing your own kind of personal stuff and, you know, earning money at the same time. So what was the Velvet Arena about? How did that come about?
The Velvet Arena was a sort of way for me to be in London at social events and understand. It was a sort of passport to London in some ways for me. In some ways, one might understand it as a binary opposite to the Pictures from the Real World series.
Right.
In that I was photographing people at social events, at the Groucho, at Hamilton's, at Private Views in Mayfair and Soho, who had economic and social power, in fact, more than me at that point.
Mm.
And so you can see there's a sort of binary shift in some ways to what I was looking at. Also, I mean, I found it also was sort of a way of being around and getting to know people as well.
Yeah.
Plus, I went to lots of really great parties. So, you know, it was a sort of hard work, enjoyable, exciting time. Again, I'm thinking again about making photographs that suit the situation that I'm in. A lot of those photographs from the Velvet Arena are very close up. They're about detail. They're about a real, almost forensic scrutiny of people. Part of that was born from the physical circumstances of me being in crowded rooms and finding things to photograph that had proximity. So you're drawing out a sort of social metaphors, if you like, from the environment.
Mm.
So yeah, it was a very exciting thing to do. Visually, I was excited by what was happening there.
So you sort of, you know, this is about kind of picking a style or a kind of consistent, you know, aesthetic that is in some way, appropriate to the subject, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's essential that we don't just, project our way of doing things on whatever it is we're dealing with. I think one always has to find the appropriate visual language to deal with content that runs through, the way of shooting, the design of a book, the way an exhibition is installed. It all has to be considered as one main thing from the larger body of work, but all has to have a sort of a discourse. It all has to, a dialogue with each other.
Did you make a book? You did make a book of that project, right? That
The Velvet Arena.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a small book. It was funded by the Photographers Gallery. David Chandler was very important, pivotal in that show happening and acquiring funds to make this. Actually, I'll say it's a book. It's a catalogue, really, I suppose.
Right, right.
It had an ISBN.
Right,
it's
yeah.
a lovely little...
Counts.
Yes, it had a lovely little catalogue of work. And I'd like that idea of sort of, because I'm sort of uncomfortable in some ways about selling prints from pictures from the real world. And when I have, James Hyman taking archive prints, indicates that the pictures from the real world, is seen as a valid document of British social history, an aspect of British social history.
Hmm.
Any history is an aspect of. And I have sold other prints from that series, but there's a slight discomfort at doing that, selling pictures of other people's lives.
Because you feel that in some way exploited.
It gets back to the consent again,
yeah.
Now, I have offered both Lisa and John some payment this year, actually, for when we did the beginning of the slideshow,
right.
Which was a really nice thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
So there's some balancing of that going on. But with the Velvet Arena, it was a slightly different thing. I mean, the other projects that I've made, like the Commons or the Last Things, where I'm creating a visual spectacle from power, institutional power, as opposed to people who are in less powerful circumstances, was much more comfortable. So the Velvet Arena, people are less identifiable.
Mm.
It's about hands, it's about gestures,
it's
about fabric of somebody's jacket. So there's... Those I'm quite happy to sell those prints more so than pictures from the real world.
Mm.
And I think when I think about showing pictures in the real world as well, I never make large prints of it anymore. Mm. You saw yourself in Arles this year in the Home Sweet Home show that my prints were relatively small compared to other photographers.
Yeah.
And there are reasons for that. I'm wanting to sort of diminish the spectacle, if you
right.
like, of, a documentary view of the working classes.
Yeah. But you also have this side to your kind of interest, which is the kind of apparatus of the state, I suppose one would say. Is that something you're still interested in?
Well, I've done sort of three bodies of work around that, two of which have been published. The Commons followed on from the Velvet Arena. If we think about the Velvet Arena as me turning the camera back around, and with the Commons, I'm still looking in that direction. I'm still looking at institutional power.
Mm.
Arranged access. I mean, it's very relevant now, of course, as we sit here in 2019 and nearly October, where all the shenanigans that are happening in Westminster are making people very angry. So the idea of looking back at the state, scrutinising the state, albeit in a metaphoric way, it was relevant for me then as... to find some political agency that I couldn't put anywhere else.
Mm.
I was trying to vote a particular government out and it was not working.
Yeah.
So now, having said that, the Commons is not a party political broadcast on the behalf of any particular political party. It's an attempt to consider the machinations of the state through use of text and image as well, and just to put it under scrutiny, which is what the document does.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what you did was you shot there's no people or portraits in that project. You just shot, the actual environment. You just did some quite sort of almost detailed close-up stuff of, the actual place, mm-hmm. the House of Commons, this kind of seat of power, and you focused on, detail, really.
Yeah, it's a sort of forensic project. It's the way it turned out, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I was aware of when you go and photograph in the House of Commons chamber, it's quite interesting how the space itself, when you look through the lens, orders itself very easily.
Mm.
There are converging parallels if you look down the benches, and there's all those sorts of images that one could make.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was important that I sort of broke through that a little bit.
Right.
And tried to look at it in a way which didn't relay the institution as a powerful apparatus and look beyond those converging parallels. Does that make sense? Trying to break it down a little bit.
Completely. Yeah.
So the visual strategy, I mean, again, if you're talking about the way that one might approach a project, I mean, that became the relevant thing to do, in my view, with the commons, to show it in ways that people had not seen it before. Whereas with the next State Apparatus project, which was The Last Things, which was my 2007 book with Dowie Lewis, I'm looking in a secret space in central London, which is a live environment, not Cold War nostalgia, right? But because that space was sort of unknown and still not particularly acknowledged by the government or by the state, actually, it was really important that I stood back and showed people what it was, what it actually looked like, rather than breaking it down.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was there's a different visual strategy required to sort of engage with that particular environment.
This now can bring us back to sort of Lisa and John, because it's quite appropriate. They sort of pop up every sort of every so often, because
a few years perhaps.
That is that kind of project, I think, that will always be be there. And as we've already sort of mentioned, the book was published in 2012. Pictures from the Real World. Does the title go all the way back to the beginning?
Yes,
it does. You
that
always
was my
had
original
that.
Title.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What happened? What is happening now? Which sort of brings us sort of back to the where we started out in a way, which is the present. Is that you've got this new book, The Lisa and John Slideshow. Now, not only is it in a little book, but there is also, we have already mentioned, a play, which will intrigue people. So how did it come back into your head that in a way that Pictures from the Real World was something that needed to be revisited in some way?
So James bought the work. James Hyman bought the work. As I said, that reactivated some interest in me to do something with it. It was 25 years. It's a nice sort of figure.
Yeah. It's a nice anniversary, figure. Yeah.
Margaret Thatcher passed away. So all these elements sort of added up, really. And what happened was that I showed some other work from that time in the Format International Photography Festival in Derby in 2011 or 2013, I can't remember, 2011. And from that exhibition, Lisa, who, as you know now, is one of the mothers from one of the families, contacted me. And I went to see her. And we just had a chat. And I was thinking, we should do some more work. Should sort of respond to pictures from the real world. And part of my desire to respond was what I'd referred to earlier, really, was this sort of idea of addressing issues, ethical issues, representational issues that were present when I made pictures of the real world, albeit they weren't necessarily consciously present, that they were very definitely in the ether for me. So I said, look, I'd like to do something, but I don't know what it is. But it doesn't involve making more photographs. I knew that from the very start. Right. I knew that it had to be work about the other work to make this kind
so
of
So there
function.
Was never any question of taking any new pictures for you?
No, not at all.
Interesting.
So in the intervening years, I mean, there's a guy at Goldsmiths called Christopher Wright who has made a book called The Shape of Things, which is about returning daguerreotypes and photographs to descendants of sort of 19th century subjects of the colonial camera. So this idea of photographs being returned to the space was sort of a sort of interesting thing for reconsideration, for looking at, So the idea sort of came from there initially. There's no idea here of theatre whatsoever. The idea was just very much step by step. So Lisa and John now have been divorced for 20 years, not really spoken very much. They live quite close to each other, within a mile, but they've not really seen each other or spoken. Both have new families, new children, so on and so forth. And so I contacted John. He said, yeah, I could get involved with that as well. So I gave them the archive, basically. I gave them both copies of the contact prints of all of their work from 1987, 1988, and left them with them for 6 months. I said, I'd just like you to pick your own pictures from this. So that began this dialogue between the three of, three of us all together, but two separate dialogues for me, one with Lisa, one with John. From that came an audio transcript. I sat with Lisa while she went through the choices with her husband, new husband Craig, sat with John as he went through his, recorded our dialogue, and thought, okay, so what we're going to do with this, because we've got this fantastic example of agency, choice being given back to two people who were formerly subjects of an archive. I like this idea. I like this idea from a political point of view. I'm thinking of people like Augustus Boal, Theatre of the Oppressed, the idea of actually working with communities to better lives, to facilitate new knowledge and so on and so forth. And so in the meantime, again, there's a big intervening period, of course. There's 30 years to talk about right? Or 25 years at that point. In the meantime, I've been interested in acting myself. I've done a few some night classes. I've acted in plays.
Oh, really?
Wow. Directed a little bit. So I've actually been in theatre on a stage acting in a play, which is terrifying.
I can imagine.
I liken it to teaching because it's quite similar. You walk into a room and people read you from top to toe. You set the tone. It's very interesting kind of comparisons between the two. But what I did first of all was go to Lisa and John and say, look, we've got these transcripts. I'd like to do something where you're talking about your choices because it's important to me that you've made your own choices independent of this Pictures in the Real World book. I'm giving you a sort of selection, albeit it's all my work. I understand that. It's not, it's not a full free choice that you're choosing from my archive. So it's important that I want to work with that in some sort of public way. So I asked them both if they'd want to be involved in some sort of discussion format or some sort of presentation or so on. And they both said no quite firmly,
right.
Which is not surprising because they're not trained or it's not their life to stand up in front of groups of people and talk about, choosing this picture over that picture or, memories of me being in the room photographing them. I came to this idea that maybe this can be a performance, maybe this can be theatre, maybe it can be another representational tableau, not the photographic one, right? But another, because theatre's representation, obviously. So it's another and complex relationship with the original body of work through performing the agency of Lisa and John, but through actors, holding it together. So that's how this idea came about. So it's a very long-winded description. I do apologize.
No, but not at all. No, it requires some explanation.
Actually trying to get funding for this project was a nightmare because of the complexities of it. In some ways, I can say, I could have said to you two subjects of my previous archive, chose pictures, and now we've turned them into a play, but that would just be selling everybody short.
Everyone wants to know exactly how this came about. Yeah. Actually, I was going to ask you about how does one get funding for something like that? Because it did become, essentially, you wrote the play, or you turned their words into dialogue, and then it has been performed, and hopefully it will be performed again in the future, but it has certainly been performed a number of times. And I guess each time it is, you need the money to pay for that to happen.
Yeah, well, I didn't get any Arts Council funding for this, and I think actually because my application was too complex, actually. I should have, because Lisa and John was an entire show. The theatrical output, the book here, was part of that. It was the biggest part of it. But there were other things going on as well. I made, I commissioned and designed, I designed and commissioned three-dimensional maquettes of me making photographs from pictures in the real world. So museological devices, which again look back at the process in some ways. There's also an installation that we built using the same audio that we developed for the script. So the slideshow, the script, was part of three things. And when I look back at the funding choice, I sort of just tried to get money for one rather than three, which is nutty. Mm. And it's harder to get money out of Arts Council now anyway. So we were lucky we got academic funding. There was a lot of payment, a lot of goodwill. I was very grateful to Hugh Davis, Professor Hugh Davis of the University of Derby, who, having known my work for some while, gave us a space at Derby Theatre for the Format Festival to put the play on for the first time before I'd even written the thing. So he was fantastically facilitatory for us. He said, you can have this space for 3 days.
Yeah, that's great.
So we were able to pay everybody a little bit of money, which was good. Probably slave wages if you look at the hours we put in.
Yeah, but that's often the way
it goes at the beginning of a sort of thing. So yeah, that's how it worked in terms of finance, you know.
No, and I'm guessing that. So what happens is that while the actors are sort of speaking the dialogue, we can see the images projected at the same time, basically.
So basically, what the Lisa and John slideshow is actors playing Lisa and John, and basically they're presenting their choices to the audience and talking about what memory has been activated. They are arguing about who is who in certain photographs. So it's about the fallibility of memory. There's sadness and there's comedy as well. I've never written anything before, but we managed to make people cry and people laugh every time it's been performed, which is an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, that's
amazing. Partly due to the sort of Alan Mosley and Sarah Toogood who have been acting in it so far up to this point. So it's good, and it's sort of unconventional as well. The theatre's unconventional as well. The fourth wall is definitely not existing with this body of work, because I also act in it myself as myself.
Right, yeah, I was going to say.
So there's a character called David.
This is very meta.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm afraid so. Yeah. There's a character called David who...
Yeah.
There's a dialogue happening with David who's in the audience all the way through.
I mean, when you sort of came to write, how were you feeling about your own sort of abilities? Were you sort of insecure about whether it was going to even be something you could pull off, or are you generally quite sort of self-confident about these things, or you know, do you just
I felt like I'm in my 50s, right?
Yeah.
So I felt like I knew enough to do an okay sort of job on it. And that was enough, given the fact that it's fairly unique in its design, the idea. I don't know of any precedent where this has occurred, this relationship between an archive and theatre performance. I'm sure there will be people thinking, oh, well, I know this and I know that, when they're listening to
Maybe.
Me say that. But I wasn't aware of any when I made it. So I suppose the sort of novelty of that, as well as, you know, I'd like to think I've got a fairly good command of English language.
Yeah.
You know, but so how it was, it's verbatim, it's essentially verbatim theatre.
Yeah, so you weren't going from scratch. It's not like you had a blank sheet of paper and that the terror of, you know, just starting from scratch. You had some material to work with, which was the actual, you know, recordings of their speech. And as you say, that's the correct term. The verbatim theatre is the right word for it, right?
Yeah.
You're basically taking as your source material actual spoken language, and then you're...
Essentially verbatim. Obviously, it's sort of slightly shaped. I mean, there are various methodologies of verbatim theatre where the writer everything will be included, every we didn't do that with this. I felt there had to be more of an economy in some ways. And also, because Lisa and John have never actually met, they've never met for 20 years, we had to devise scenes between the two of them when they're talking about certain photographs. So that's not verbatim.
Right.
So when we got actors into character and they were significantly developed, and that involved both Sarah and Alan going to Derby and meeting Lisa and John, when they were significantly confident about who they thought Lisa and John were, we devised scenes of them meeting and talking about photographs.
Right. Interesting. And then so I guess the final sort of element is that we've now got a new book, this little book, The Lisa and John Slideshow, which the great thing, one of the great things about it is, as we mentioned now, the original book has got very few images in it, there's only 18 pictures.
Yep.
So it's a sort of super tight edit, but the new book's got some extra ones in it, hasn't it? It's got
about 40 extra ones.
Way more.
Yeah.
Why did the original book have so few images?
Because I was thinking, when I came round to it being a book and everyone agreeing that it could be a book, I thought, gosh, I've waited so long for this particular thing. Even though I wasn't thinking about publishing it all the way through the 25 years, I thought, it's taken such a long time to see the light of day. I have to do the edit. No one else can do it.
Yeah.
So, and it came to that. I have to say, there was some pictures in this Lisa and John book that I wish I'd actually bought into the original sequence of pictures from the real world. But it was a thing there that I just couldn't let anyone else in. Dowie wanted to get involved with the edit. Yeah. I didn't want to.
Well, normally, I would guess sort of someone like Dowie normally is sort of fighting to take pictures out. But in your case, it was probably the other way around. It's like, there's only, you know, 18 is the, yeah. you can't really get away with any fewer than that.
Maybe, I don't know. I wouldn't say never to anything.
No, sure. But, you know, people have a certain expectation that, you know, a photo book's surely going to have 30, 40, whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, the new one's lovely. It's a small thing, but we've got more pictures, and we also have the actual transcript or the actual script in
there. Yeah, I mean, essentially, I mean, this was led by the need or the desire to publish the script. That's what led this publication. And for me, the photographs are actually secondary in some ways.
Well, you could look at it either way, couldn't you? It's whichever you want.
In terms of the design, they sort of take equal precedent in, for sure.
Well, it's two for one. You know, you're getting both.
Yeah, but I'm very happy to have the script published. I mean, you know, that's fantastic. You know?
Yeah.
I like the idea, perhaps, of somebody else putting the play on in years to come as well. That would be an interesting thing.
Hopefully, that will happen.
So yeah. I made a sort of decision after, because we showed Lisa and John at Derby Theatre, we showed it at the Regent Street Cinema in Central London, which was a fantastic venue. So we did two or three shows at each of those venues, and also at the Mac Theatre in Belfast, because Lisa and John showed at Belfast Exposed in 2018. And I sort of decided I didn't want to do it anymore, but a couple of people have asked me if I can do it next year and in 2021. So and I'm thinking, I've got the book now, it might just be an easy thing to do, relatively speaking.
Mm.
All of the sort of, you know, blood, sweat and tears, you know, in terms of getting this going has occurred.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways with my own work, I'm not very commercially minded in that sense, because other people would look at this and think, oh, you have a project. You have a product now.
I
don't think of it like that at all.
No,
I think it was a sort of a rite of passage, perhaps, to do it and to do it in this particular way with different intentions at its heart.
And has this sort of achieved its aim, as it were, of somehow alleviating whatever discomfort you still had, over all that perceived transgression and that kind of stuff?
In some ways it has. In some ways I'm not totally figured it out yet. I like the idea of theatre being a fluid representational device rather than something that's fixed, and also within the script, and this was not encouraged when I was talking to Lisa and John, but there's criticism of me. You know, Lisa at one point criticizes me. He said he'd bring these pictures round, but he never did.
Right. Yes.
So the sort of narrative is laced with this sort of a disinclination to fully enjoy it, in terms of Lisa and John's experience. There's a little bit of a critique going on there about the processes that, you know, lots of photographers are involved with. So that's part of it. So that I enjoy that very much.
You've had a chance to indulge in a little bit of self-flagellation to some extent.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah, which is, but like you say, I mean, that's, you know, it's a thing that we've all, I think that, you know, those feelings are ones that we've all dealt with or, you know, experienced. So it's lovely to sort of, you know, acknowledge that really for everyone in a way. So what else have you, I mean, what's happening next? I mean, obviously you know, you're very much sort of full-time, teacher, educator. So I imagine that takes up a significant amount of your time. But have you got anything else on the horizon?
I work as a fraction. I'm course leader of MA Documentary Photography and Photojournalism at Westminster, University of Westminster. And I'm there sort of three quarters of the week, just under three quarters of the week in terms of my pay packet. And so I'm looking at getting other bodies of work out from the 90s at the moment, and also thinking about larger sort of performance pieces around documentary and representation, which is very exciting. I think now the archive of work I want to get out from the 90s, some of which has been exhibited, some of it's not been seen. What I'm proposing is any exhibition of that would also involve a performance element in some way, which is sort of an intervention into a social space as well. So it's very much with me, this idea of performance and photography and representation of, and performance as well. So there are a few things cooking at the moment as well.
Cool, great.
What I wanted to say,
yeah, go on.
If I could just
please do.
Add on was with, and it's sort of important to kind of say this really, because you asked me about whether or not I'd sort of distilled all my sort of anxieties and guilt about all the representational faults of the original bodies of work. When we showed the Lisa and John slideshow for the first time at Derby Theatre in 2017, after the first performance, we had a Q&A, and Claire, who is the little girl in the bucket on the front of the cover of the new book, had been to see the play. I'd contacted her, and she came to see the play that evening, and she joined myself, Val Williams, who wrote a fine essay for this, and the actors, and Gavin Dent, who's the assistant director. She joined us on stage for the Q&A. So that was, for me, it was a fantastic moment. Something came around there. Something was complete with Nicola joining us on stage and taking questions about the process.
Is her memory of it still quite strong?
She had no memory whatsoever of me being there.
Right.
But then neither did John.
And neither did John, because she would be what, about five or six or something, maybe
three, four, five, something like that. Yeah,
pretty
four,
young.
Five, yeah,
yeah.
So, but she had no memory, and but luckily she liked the play.
That's good. And you know, I mean, I guess Lisa and John themselves should have the final word. I mean, what's their take on it? I imagine
they've not seen it.
They haven't seen it.
No, John was ill. He had some bad health for a while, and I think he's recovered now. And I felt that Lisa was perhaps too shy to come.
Oh, right, okay.
But the children came, and I've invited... We had three of the kids there. And I say Nicola came on stage. But I invited them all to, you know, but it's not happened yet that they've actually seen it. They have a video recording of it, which I don't let public. They have a copy of this book.
Right, right.
For now, that's how it is.
Well, that's a nice kind of, you know, artifact for them to, you know, have. Strange, isn't it? This sort of little chunk of their lives that was recorded.
Lisa's very generous about it. So I said, look, do you mind me doing this? I'll tell them if anything's happening, like this book is coming out, or there's a bit in The Guardian or whatever. As I say, I've sort of made some financial reparations this year.
Well, I'm going to end with a couple of general questions. If you could, like, give any advice to that 21-year-old David who, you know, was just about to go off to Farnham, what would be your main words of advice?
I'd think that there's always hesitation when you're younger about ideas that you have. So it's just about being able to identify things which have not quite taken shape yet and act on them. I mean that's the biggest thing, really, and something I say to students now, really, and not at that stage thinking things through too much, you know.
Right
It's about action in every sense, in political, creative sense. It's about doing things, you know. One learns from that, so that would be the sort of biggest thing, I think.
What advice do you find yourself giving to your students sort of repeatedly? Is there anything in particular that seems to come up a lot?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's an extension of that.
I'm just saying,
just do it.
Right.
Just go and do it, see what happens.
Yeah.
So it's through learning through experience. It's essential.
Are you relatively optimistic about photography in general in the future, given the massive changes that we've experienced in the way that the industry is, you know, and the way that photography is, you know, being kind of produced?
Optimism isn't the word I'd use, but neither would I say pessimistic. It's just changed. You know, you've said it's exploded in a multitude of directions, multidimensional directions, and is accessible to all. I guess there'll always be photography while people want to take photographs.
That's a perfect place to end it. David, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you. It was great to meet you. And good luck with the launch of the Lisa and John slideshow later on.
Thank you, Ben.